KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Yeah, register to vote. You know the drill. Okay, public health announcement. If you are going fishing in Houston's bayous, you should think twice before eating your catch of the day. Many anglers know if you catch a fish in one of Houston's plentiful bayous, the right thing to do is release it back into the water. Still, curious minds wonder, can you instead eat what you catch? Technically, the answer is yes, it's not illegal. State health officials wouldn't recommend it, though. Many bayous in the area, including Buffalo Bayou, are part of the Houston Ship Channel, where the Texas Department of State Health Services, or DSHS, has found water containing potentially unsafe levels of pollutants. In 2015, DSHS issued an advisory against eating fish and crabs from the Houston Ship Channel and Upper Galveston Bay after finding unacceptable levels of PCBs, pesticides, and other contaminants in the water. PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, I believe is what they are, can negatively impact a person's immune system and vital organs. The risk is even greater for expectant mothers. Eating large amounts of fish containing PCBs can cause infants to have delayed physical and physical development and learning difficulties. Because of the potential health impacts, DSHS advises that children and women of childbearing age, of course, not children of childbearing age, children and women of childbearing age is how I should have read that, entirely should avoid eating fish and crabs from Houston's bayous. As for adult men and women past childbearing age, DSHS recommends only consuming 8 ounces of fish a month at most, you know, or maybe none.
Yeah. I was going to ask what PCBs in this case stood for, because I'm mostly familiar with them as circuit boards. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Apparently, it says in the story that they're used, they used to be used as coolant in like high capacity transformers.
Right.
But they were so dangerous that they have discontinued them, but they remain in the environment and body tissues for a really long time.
Yeah, so this is a chemical rather than any particular trash or anything. Although I'm sure that that's probably decently present in the Ship Channel as well.
PCBs are in a lot of stuff because they were used so long and they got into the food chain. And it's not just a matter of where they are disposed of or leaked. It's also in lesser amounts in other parts of the environment just because organisms.
Yeah, well, it is kind of sad, I think, that, you know, we've got this body of water that is an ecosystem, and, you know, we could be interacting with that ecosystem in a natural way of catching food there and eating it. But no, we can't do that because we've polluted the whole area. And I wonder if there are any serious efforts to try and clean that up. And I would presume that that would be sort of a university grant funded program kind of thing.
Well, I will say this. When I moved to Houston in 1977, like downtown Buffalo Bayou, they basically forbade boating. They forbade swimming, and there was no point in fishing because there were no living fish.
Fair enough.
So this progress has been made. This is an this is actually an improvement.
Mm. Well, hey, maybe in 10, 15, 20 years time, you'll be able to eat those fish.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Hope springs eternal. Yeah, hope springs eternal. I will repeat one of my well-used, ought-to-be-more-famous sayings, pollution is public, profit is private.
Mm.
So we're going to get to another story like that, but not right away. Next story, by the way, that was from the HoustonChronicle.com, so I thank them for not paywalling that story. CommunityImpact.com, Fort Bend County sets political hearing, I'm sorry, public hearing, discussing $4.6 million in housing community programs for low to moderate income residents. Fort Bend County conducted a public hearing June 14th for developing the fiscal year 2022 Consolidated Annual Action Plan for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Aside from this event, public comment will be accepted by phone or mail until June 30th. And there are links and stuff in the article that you can see at thinkwingradio.com or by clicking on the article from there. The purpose of the hearing was to receive comments regarding the plan's proposed projects, the most expensive of which include a $744,000 countywide housing rehabilitation program, a $630,000 countywide community development block grant program for administration and planning, otherwise known as a CBDG. We'll repeat that later, and $600,000 for phase two of sanitary sewer improvements in Rosenberg, always a good thing. These overall goals for these programs are to provide decent housing, to establish and maintain a suitable living environment, and to expand the economic opportunities for each resident of the county, particularly for low and moderate income persons. The amount of money assistance available from HUD totals $4.66 million. For CBDG, home investment partnerships, and ESG programming. Don't ask me what. A breakdown of funding per program in each category is included in the article if you're curious. So again, you can click on it. As usual, stories are significantly excerpted in order to fit them into the show.
I think the takeaway here is that if you're in Fort Bend County, you have an opportunity to read through the details of these plans. You have an opportunity to comment if you feel it's necessary. So do that. Do your due diligence. Do your homework. And at least skim the plan. Because while these are all good projects with good goals, it is this kind of somewhat nebulous, somewhat big spender project where city governments can sometimes sneak in policies that are not particularly popular or good for the community, but they serve the city in other ways, this sort of thing. So you should be aware of what's in this plan. Make sure that you like it. And if there's something in it you don't like and you live in Fort Bend County especially, make a comment and say, take this out because it's not relevant and I don't think it'll do good. So,
and that applies to any of the communities or subdivisions in Fort Bend County.
Yes.
I will half jokingly say that the range of comments that you could make by June 30th could be as simple as, I love it, go ahead.
Sure.
All the way to, I don't think we should be spending government money on this crap.
Yeah.
To, anything in between. I like plans A and B, but I think maybe they could be tweaked in a certain way. So there's a whole range of, I don't want the money, to please spend more, to here's how I think the expenditures could be improved or better targeted.
Sure.
Try to seriously consider doing your civic duty and participating. Mm. It's your county. By the way, I also included a reference link to the Community Development Block Grant Program if you are curious, because I'm obsessive that way. Okay, our next story from CommunityImpact.com. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner announces, you notice no one calls him Sly Turner. I guess that wouldn't be a good nickname for a politician.
I mean, yeah, it would be a little bit of a hindrance at election time.
Yeah, it could be by some measures too on the nose. But in any case, Sylvester Turner announces decision, and this is a follow-up story for us, the decision to move forward with 11th Street Bikeway Project. Following a previous announcement from Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, should I start calling him Sly Turner? Nah, that would be, I think if I didn't like him, I could start.
Yeah, and it is a little bit Trumpian, I would say, to start giving politicians nicknames, I think. I don't know about that.
Well, it's not the cruelest of nicknames. I mean, Sylvester Stallone is often referred to as Sly Stallone. It is a diminutive for Sylvester. I just think that a conscious decision was made by Sylvester Turner that he doesn't want to be Sly Turner. I mean, that's a little like tricky dick, you know?
So, yeah.
Okay, last you'll hear about that from me. Anyhow, he made a decision on the proposed 11th Street Bikeway project in the Heights. He announced his decision to allow the project to move forward on June 14th, or will move forward, I guess, on June. Yeah, that was yesterday. So he did make that announcement. Anyway, you get my idea. Turner decided to take ownership of the project after hearing multiple residents from the Heights come forward at Houston City Council public sessions with concerns regarding the scope of the project. As previously reported by Community Impact newspaper, the project will make improvements along a 1.5-mile stretch of 11th Street from Shepherd Drive to Michaux Street, as well as on Michaux Street from 11th Street South to Studi Park. The project will reduce the number of lanes through what is called a road diet and implement new protected bike lanes. Road diet. I'm willing to try anything, but I don't know if that means I'm supposed to run or drive. Anyway, despite pushback from some community members, others have come out in support of the project, as has the cycling advocacy group Bike Houston. The 11th Street Bikeway project is part of Turner's Vision Zero, a commitment to end traffic deaths and serious injuries in Houston by 2030. According to the city's February 7th presentation, the city wants to address dangerous speeds seen on the road, where vehicle speeds average 38.5 miles per hour outside the 30 mile per hour speed limit. Now, I just want to inject here. If that's the average speed, that means some people are going way too fast. If that was the maximum speed that people did on that street, I would actually consider that pretty tolerable. But if it's an average, that means some people are doing 45 and 50, and that is just a no.
Yeah, well, the article seems to have printed average. So
yeah, exactly that. It says we'll average. So they might have said as high as blah, blah, but they didn't, so we must infer. Anyway, according to the presentation, the project will also address a problem with crashes. The Texas average for undivided roads of four or more lanes, the current configuration of 11th Street, is 356, while the average on 11th Street from Shepherd to Heights is 385. In his announcement video, which there is a link to in the article, Turner said the street encourages fast driving with crashes at every intersection between Michaux and Shepherd. According to a group known as the Alliance for Reasonable Traffic Solutions, a group made up of residents who are against the project, the street already meets Vision Zero requirements, with crashes being concentrated primarily at three intersections, Yale, Heights Boulevard, and Studewood. Officials with the ARTS said that they, the ARTS being the Alliance for Reasonable Traffic Solutions, the officials with the ARTS said they would rather see targeted improvements at key intersections instead of revamping the entire roadway. They have also called on officials to finish considering bikeways on 14th Street and putting a bikeway on 19th Street instead of on 11th. Opponents said they believe the plan will lead to fewer customers for businesses and could result in more traffic conflict for bicyclists from cars entering and exiting driveways on 11th. Other concerns include the effects of narrowing 11th on delivery trucks. Yeah, narrowing, man, is tough. Anyway, narrowing 11th on delivery trucks and the potential for cars to resort to neighborhood side streets to get around if congestion worsens, increasing risk to pedestrians on those streets. Despite the fight against 11th Street, Stacy Seals, a member of the ARTS and a longtime Heights resident, emphasized the group is not opposed to the bike lanes. Turner said the city will continue to monitor the area once the project is completed to see if traffic goes to neighborhood streets. If the data shows cut-through traffic is an issue, he said they will have treatment budgeted to fix it. Of course, I'm sure if that happens, it will take 5 to 10 years in order to plan the treatment, have discussions about the treatment, have hearings about the treatment. So, you know, whatever. I think, you know, I'm mostly a driver and I am not great at walking great distances because of my back issues and sacroiliac stuff. So, you know, for me, a walkable city almost sounds like the start of a horror movie. On the other hand, there are many people that love it until they hit like 50 or 60. So I've made my feelings on this clear in previous shows. Andrew, you have as well, but is there anything you want to add?
Well, yeah, because I think that this is an evolution of the situation, because the previous opposition that has been presented in the articles that we've covered before has essentially just been, we don't like this because of these reasons. And it hasn't been suggesting any kind of alternative to improving cycle infrastructure.
That's not true. I've made suggestions about improving cycle infrastructure.
But has the article?
Well, I can't speak for the article. I'm not writing it, and nobody's consulting me, and I live in the Western Heights, so I'm not part of that community. But, you know, for me, I would say narrowing lanes is always problematic. You know, I once, of a couple of times, taken car trips from Houston to Southeast Florida. And, you know, traveling behind these big rigs, and there's a little road construction. One of the things they do with road construction to give themselves a little more space to work is they'll shrink those lanes maybe a foot. Now, the widest standard for traffic lanes in the United States is the standard for interstate highways, because they're made not only for massive trucks, but also in emergency for military equipment. So those are the widest standard lanes. I was driving through a stretch of Mississippi where the lanes were so narrow that one of these trailers, tractor trailers, I don't know how the guy could drive without just constant white knuckles, because I swear his tires were edge to edge on that lane.
Wow.
I mean, imagine doing that for 100 miles. Now, we're not talking the interstate in Mississippi. We're talking 11th Street in the Heights. But I think that the analogy is not really off, because you do have small cars for whom slightly narrower lanes are not a big deal. Then you have SUVs, you have work vans, you have delivery vans, you have delivery panel trucks, which are not quite as wide as tractor trailers, but they get close. And, you know, there are times when everybody has a little trouble staying in lane, either because you're distracted or, you know, whatever. I guess it's always some kind of distraction. Sometimes you're just not at 100%. Maybe you didn't get enough sleep. Maybe you had a hard day at work. And tracking a narrower lane can create an opportunity for head-on collisions or drifting into a bike lane. So
the difference, I think, between this article and previous articles that have been covering the opposition to this is that the previous articles have just focused on the opposition without having the people expressing that opposition indicate any alternatives or support for alternatives. We've had discussions about possible alternatives, but that hasn't been in the article text itself.
It sounds like there were alternatives expressed, but just it sounds like maybe they didn't make it into the article.
Right. Now, what's good about this article is that, you know, the arts group here is specifically saying, hey, there are other places that these bike lanes could be put in, and there are, you know, other changes that could be made on 11th Street. And, you know, basically they're willing to be flexible, and they're not opposing the ideas of bike lanes completely. And that's workable. That is, you know, an area where compromise is possible and a better plan that works for more people can be sorted out. I will say, I don't necessarily buy the fewer customers for businesses idea. I think that generally we find...
Well, they'll go someplace where it's easier to get to, assuming there's, you know, inconvenience in using that road.
Well,
if traffic gets heavier...
Hang on. When what we've seen is when areas are actually pedestrianized, one of the comments is, well, it'll be more difficult. You know, people won't want to bother going there because they can't drive there. What we've seen is that people actually increase traffic to those areas because it feels safer, and they are able to, you know, they have more space to congregate. There's more space for, you know, roadside stalls and this sort of thing. So there is actually more business there. There is a bigger draw to those areas.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to cite a statistic, but is this a statistic you have seen, or is this like one of the 90% of statistics are made up?
Well, this is anecdotal, but this is another, I can point to a specific, I don't know where it is, but I'm going back to London for this. There is a specific section of a London street that was pedestrianized against some, you know, outcry from local business owners. And it was found that people actually increased their shopping visits there.
Well, let's look at a couple of possible alternative situations.
Okay.
If you pedestrianize an area. It's possible, and this is speculation on my part.
And it's worth mentioning, this is not talking about pedestrianizing 11th Street.
No, but you're talking about cutting down traffic, which has the effect of potentially reducing car patronage.
Yes.
And relying more, which I guess is the point I was getting to, more on local pedestrian patronage.
Yes.
I will say I have a flashback to Brooklyn where when people go shopping, they have these carts they haul behind them with their shopping Mm-hmm. You know, like you may think of them as old lady carts, but really everybody in New York has one for whether it's laundry or grocery shopping or whatever. And I could see potentially people who live nearby, you know, within, say, a quarter of a mile or so, going with these carts and doing their shopping and putting their shopping in the cart and walking it home rather than carrying it. So that's an option. And sure. What you may end up with is a swap in patronage between people driving from further away, not wanting to mess with it, yeah. and people from closer by being more willing to either maybe take a big trike with a shopping basket or walking there with one of these trailing baskets or whatever.
And in fairness, I understand the argument about narrower lanes being terrifying. There is a road. I live out in Pearland, and so I'm not going to be intimately familiar with the details of the 11th Street proposal, but there's a road that I travel pretty regularly to get into some of the shopping that's around me. And it's a narrow road. It's a narrower road than I really have to drive in any other circumstance. And it is a little bit scary. So I understand. It's not, and I'm in a...
You try to avoid it?
I avoid it when I don't... I avoid it when I can get to something else.
The short version of this is you avoid it when you can.
Yeah, I avoid it when I can. I only go on to it when it's beneficial to me, is perhaps a better way of putting it. Which
now,
is
I
like
will tell you, when I was growing up in New York, there was a road that ran from Brooklyn to Queens called the Interborough Expressway. It was built during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
The roads... The lanes were narrow because really they were sized for cars being built in the 20s and 30s. Mm. It ran through a cemetery, so it was very curvy because they basically built it where they could get permission to relocate bodies.
Right.
And I have to tell you, it was one of the most terrifying roads I drove in New York because not only – and I was just driving a passenger car. It was nothing big. Like I drive a minivan now. I was driving like a Plymouth Scamp. Mm-hmm. And it was narrow and it was windy and it was kind of white knuckle for me. I mean, I was younger at the time, but I don't think I was alone.
Right.
And, you know, I used to joke that if you're going to get into a fatal accident, this was the most convenient road to get into it on because you can just plow straight into the cemetery and you're there.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Jeez.
Dark humor. Dark humor.
But,
okay.
But yeah, it's a good indicator. This is a situation now where there is a potential for compromise, and that should be taken advantage of.
And the way these kinds of projects work, it's never so far along that it can't be halted if there's enough community resistance. So if people, I think, in the vicinity, in the neighborhood, see it taking an unfortunate direction, I assume that the protests will rise again. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2 Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can listen online at kpft.org. You can podcast the show through your podcast app. You can also listen to older shows of not only Think Wing, but like 100 other programs we broadcast at archive.kpft.org. On this show, because we cover so many stories, every story on the show is heavily excerpted, some extremely so. So I do link to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can find shows by clicking on the tab Show Posts and More at the top of the page. You can find shows by show date. You can type keywords into the search bar. We are on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. Look for me on Twitter, rather, at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
I personally think that calling a road diet the question between walking or driving to be a pretty stupid joke, so I think I'm there with you.
Yeah, I'm going to remember that one, because I'll see if I can use it on my stream.
Okay. Keep track in case I need royalties, you know, like the music we play on the station for BMI.
Yeah, okay, I will.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Because, you know, us people, we try to dip our fingers wherever we can get our creative juices compensated. Our next story from KHOU.com. Judge Lena Hidalgo proposes $48 million for early childhood education. Harris County Judge Hidalgo wants to invest millions into early childhood ed. She's proposing spending $48 million to provide additional resources for parents and communities, but the plan needs approval from the county commissioners. I was going to say the five county commissioners, of which three are Democrats, so, but now I've said it. The money could provide some relief for parents struggling to find affordable child care. Early learning centers would also benefit if the plan is approved. Resources would also be crucial as child care centers are bouncing back from the COVID disruptions. The money will be coming from the American Rescue Plan funds if the commissioners agree. There have been repeated studies that show that children who experience early childhood learning, pre-K, almost uniformly do much better in school, and both in terms of socialization, learning discipline, learning flexibility, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, assuming that you consider humans your most important natural resource, something Republicans apparently rarely do, this is likely to be money well spent. Andrew?
Yeah, I don't see any downside to this. I mean, I suppose the only argument is maybe there could be a better use for the American Rescue Plan funds, but I mean, the money to do this would have to come from somewhere. It might as well come from that. And this is a good cause.
Well, the American Rescue Plan funds are intended to help minimize the deleterious effects of COVID when essentially businesses were closing temporarily, sometimes permanently. People weren't coming to work. Staffing was hard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the way I interpret the article, and there is a little more to it than what I've read, I see it as partly priming the pump to help these businesses get back up and running, and partly providing assistance to people of modest incomes who otherwise, essentially, they're working just to put their kids in daycare, pretty much, you know, between commuting costs, lunch money, and childcare. There are families where the cost of all of that is barely less than what they make in their second job. Some women will tell you that, yeah, it really sucks that that's the case, but they're grateful to get out of the house.
Mm.
And sometimes for them, that's the payoff. And that shouldn't be the only payoff.
Yeah.
So, I think this is basically a good thing. Okay, next story. This is interesting. This is from offthecuff.com, Charles Kuffner. Normally, he excerpts stories and then makes some comments at the beginning and the end. Here, I think he actually went out of the way to dig up some numbers. So I think it's an interesting story. It is written in first person, so essentially I'll be reading as Charles. The last time I looked, I was largely unable to find any news stories about mail ballots and their rejection rates for the May primary runoff elections, with the exception of one story about Bexar County. I don't understand why it's not Bexar, but Bexar County, and how they were leading the field in getting rejection rates down to something akin to pre-SB1 levels, SB election. I still can't find any stories about this, but it finally occurred to me that the new reconciliation reports that election officials now have to publish would contain the data I'm looking for. So with that in mind, off I went. I obviously don't have the time to go looking everywhere, and some of those smaller county election webpages are just awful, but I did have a look at a few of the places of interest. Now, I've only reported here about half of the counties that he did, you know, for time. So Harris County, Democratic, 19,081 total mail ballots, of which 1,128 were rejected for a rejection rate of 5.9. Harris County Republican ballots, 15,053 total mail ballots, of which 1,169 were rejected for a total rejection rate of 7.8%. That's a clear improvement from the 20% rejection rate for March and the 12% rejection rate of the May special election. It's still too high, but it's not take your breath away too high. And it pleases me no end, says Charles, to see Republicans have a harder time with it than Democrats. It's unlikely to be enough to matter if that's still the case in November, but it would be a rich piece of karma if more of their votes got tossed as a result of this malicious law. Nearby in Montgomery County, cumulative, 4,366 total mail ballots, of which 25 were rejected for a rejection rate of 0.6%. Republicans knew what they were doing there. They were 70% of the mail ballots. Fort Bend, cumulative, 4,382 total mail ballots, of which 187 were rejected for a total rejection rate of 4.3%. Closest one yet to Harris. About two-thirds of mail ballots were Democratic. It would have been nice to see the breakdown of party there. So it's clear there was a lot of improvement, And while Harris did a much better job, there's room for us to do better as well, us being Harris County. It's also important to remember that there are still a huge number of people who have not yet tried to vote by mail, I will add as an addendum, who may qualify. So there's no guarantee that the improvements will continue to be maintained. There's still a lot of work to do, a lot of work to be done, rather, but at least it looks like that work will have a payoff. I will also add it does look like they are trying. Of course, it would be better to just sort of go back to the original laws, which themselves were not great voting laws and were still somewhat oppressive, but apparently not nearly as bad as what we have now. You know, we talked about last week, we talked about Conroe going back to a 2018 ordinance for preserving trees. Yeah. It's like maybe we need to go back to a 2020 ordinance to preserve votes.
Well, I'm sure we would if the Democrats and slash or opposition to Republicans in the state government had enough power to do that. But
yeah, basically, what do they call it? A
supermajority.
Not a supermajority. What am I trying to think of? When you have it like a parliamentary democracy and you have parties that work to a coalition.
Oh, yeah, coalition.
Yeah, you could end up with coalition where, you know, two or three different parties other than Republicans might caucus together and come up with unified positions with some compromises, et cetera.
Yeah, I'd be all in on that as a, you know, third party voter. Yeah,
I have no objection to third parties, as I've said many times. I just think that for starters, we need to have them local. But, you know, that I think is sort of a flavor of difference between us. I don't see that as a huge obstacle in terms of our views relative to each. Okay, next story is from the TexasTribune.org. More than 165,000 people in Odessa are still without water after aging line breaks. Officials haven't specified what caused the break, but say the broken line is about 60 years old. More than 165,000 residents in Odessa have gone nearly 24 hours without water as a major water break occurred in the West Texas town and may need to boil water once service is restored. The break occurred about 6 p.m. Monday. The system will be turned back on when the repair is fixed. It was hard to locate. They had to turn off the whole system. That repair is expected to occur perhaps around 9 p.m. Wednesday. The system will then need at least 10 to 12 hours to fully restart. My suspicion, first of all, as these things go, a 60-year-old water pipeline is old, but it's not that old. There are water transmission tunnels in the Northeast that are like 150 years old. Of course, you know, it might have been built by the lowest bidder. It might have been built out of inferior materials. I can't speak to that. But I have a suspicion that while age and maybe the quality of the construction may have been a factor, I suspect that part of the problem is subsidence from water pumping, because it's an arid part of the country and probably has a lot of groundwater supplying the city and surrounds. And I suspect another part of it is probably drought, because West Texas and the whole U.S. Southwest are suffering from what has been called, according to archaeologists, the worst drought in that part of the country in 1,200 years. So, of course, when you have a drought, ground shrinks. Mm-hmm. So you've got subsidence on the one hand, perhaps. You've got ground shrinkage as it dries on the other hand, perhaps. And all of that causes everything, all underground infrastructure to shift. And if it's not flexible, and most major water conduits are not, they start to crack and ultimately fail. In Houston, we actually have, even when water is running normally in Houston, we have leaks all over the place because we are always getting with the gumbo soil we have here, where it's constantly expanding and contracting and always causing leaks someplace until somebody reports it or the city decides it's gotten too catastrophic not to repair. Andrew?
Yeah, definitely. I think the, you know, I think the officials not really releasing why exactly the pipes burst. Well, at this point, they don't necessarily know, probably. But
their first priority is to fix it, and their second priority would be to diagnose it.
Right. But I would be interested to see what the results of the investigation afterwards are, because I think you're probably right in that at least environmental factors are going to play a significant role. And the next story that we've got, which we'll deal with after the break, is also a sort of environmental situation affecting a wider area than just, you know, where the pollution is. And this is a situation where, yeah, you've got the groundwater pumping, you've got the drought, but it's affecting not just this one area where the pipe burst. It's because the pipe burst. Now, a lot of people.
Well, it will be not only a matter of water is a precious commodity in the area. It'll be a matter of you've got pollution that appears to potentially be contaminating the groundwater. Right. So we'll get to that momentarily. But in the meantime, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 CT in the morning. You can listen online at kpft.org. I recommend podcasting using your podcast app. You can also visit archive.kpft.org in order to listen not only to prior shows of this, but also prior shows of one of the 100 or so shows on KPFT. I will point out that eventually pretty much every show we do ends up getting posted to my site at Think Wing Radio on the appropriate blog post, thinkwingradio.com. KPFT is Houston's community station. As I said, it has over 100 show titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org. Honest to gosh, it's new. The webpage, and hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, ours please, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift, imagine Banner White. All and spreading the word helps, and it's free to just tell people about stuff you like on KPFT. Andrew?
Pick your favorite show and
and make it ours. Make ours.
And make it ours. Make it ours. That's a lovely thinkwingism, I think. Your favorite.
Did I say favorite?
You said favorite. And
I'm still thinking highway construction, man.
Yeah, must be.
Yeah, that favorite, those favorite roads. You know, there must be a place for an adjective like that.
Hmm.
A favorite road. Huh.
Infrastructure okay. Nerds, get on that.
In the background, look and see if that's a word. Hmm. Okay, our next story. I've been subscribing to a newsletter from nativenewsonline.net, and I have been finding some very interesting articles that should be interesting to people other than Native Americans or as well as Native Americans. So this one is called High and Dry: Toxic Coal Ash Could Be the Next Opportunity or Broken Promise for the Northern Cheyenne Tribe. In the small southeastern Montana town of Colstrip is the Colstrip Steam Electric Station. The plant's two remaining coal-fired generating units are capable of producing 1,480 megawatts of electricity. The other two units shut down in 2020, 2 years ahead of schedule, because their owners, Talon Montana and Puget Sound Energy, could not cover their costs. Colstrip has provided power to cities across the Northwest since the 1970s. Now, as state environmental regulations in Washington and Oregon require four of the plant's six owners based in these states to pull out of coal-fired power by 2025 and 2030, respectively, the plant's future is uncertain. The plant's closure would mean job losses for locals, but unemployment is not the only legacy the plant would leave behind. Questions remain about how 5 decades worth of coal ash, the toxic byproduct that contains dangerous elements like arsenic, lead, and mercury, will be cleaned up. Under the federal coal ash rule adopted in 2015, the EPA requires plant owners to submit written closure plans detailing how their coal ash will be safely stored. Over 700 coal ash units in 43 states and Puerto Rico are regulated under this law. Almost all of these units are polluting groundwater with unsafe levels of toxins, according to an analysis of company documents provided by nonprofit groups Earth Justice and the Environmental Integrity Project. The safest closure option is generally to remove coal ash from unlined ponds where it is stored and placed in lined landfills. But many companies are proposing instead to cap their unlined ponds in place to prevent rainwater infiltration. Environmentalists argue this cap-in-place strategy does not do enough to prevent contamination, as it leaves ash in contact with the earth and often with groundwater. Colstrip Steam Electric, the second largest coal-fired plant west of the Mississippi, has an enormous coal ash pond complex covering more than 800 acres. I'll talk about that at the end. Colstrip's coal ash is disposed of by mixing it with water and storing it in ponds at three areas near the plant. The water may be to keep it from turning to dust and blowing away. One of these areas involves 9 ponds storing waste from the plant's first two units, units 1 and 2. They hold enough ash to fill over 2,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. They've been leaking sulfates, boron, selenium, and other toxic heavy metals into the local aquifer for decades, releasing 43,000 gallons of contaminated water per day, according to Montana's DEQ, or Department of Environmental Quality. The consequences of leaving coal ash in the groundwater here could be deadly, said Ann Hedges, Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs at the Montana Environmental Information Center. She said there are dozens of contaminants. They cause cancer. They cause neurological disorders. They cause cardiovascular disease. These are not things you want to mess around with. Talen Energy filed for bankruptcy in May, citing $4.5 billion in debt, the Billings Gazette reported. This is alarming for environmentalists like Hedges, who think the financial assurance Talen is required to pay DEQ for ash cleanup is not enough to cover those costs should Talen disappear. Now, I wanted to give a sense of scale. We talk about 800 acres of these coal ash storage ponds. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to give a sense of scale. An acre is 43,560 square feet, which is itself a big enough number that it's hard to
Fair.
The typical family home, detached home, typically these days is built on a lot of between 5,000 and 7,000 square feet. Mm. So 1 acre might subdivide into about 8 home lots. Now multiply that by 800 acres, so this coal ash sits on land equal to about 6,400 home lots. I think that has more resonance for people than the number of Olympic pools, because I haven't swum in many.
Yeah,
that's more homes, I will add, than existed in Oak Forest, which is a community just north of the North Loop, as of 2011.
Mm.
So Oak Forest had 6,400 homes in 2011. This is enough. I'm sorry, it had 5,600 homes, rather. And this is enough for 6,400 homes. Mm. So, you know, I've said for years, I said it a little earlier in the show, that under our current system, profit is private, but pollution is public. Large energy corporations have found many ways, nefarious ways, I might add, of avoiding cleanup costs for pollution they cause. Bankruptcy is one. Spinning off polluted areas into separate corporations that later go bankrupt is another, and there are others. In one form or another, this is a national problem. So it's not just a story about exploited Native Americans. It's about exploited people everywhere. Mm. I mean, these people have a lot in common, for example, with the people in West Virginia,
yep,
who have basically the same problems. Andrew?
Yeah. Another situation this reminds me of is Giant Mine in the Northwest Territories of Canada, which is, funnily enough, very close to another First Nations reservation, where for years it was a very profitable gold mine, but that gold mining released, you know, 200,000 tons of arsenic dust, and now the company has left that area, and the government is left to try and deal with that pollution. And the solution that they've come up with is to freeze it all in the caverns that have been left over by the mine. And, you know, obviously, I don't think that would work here.
Well, funnily enough, it's part of the solution they're trying at the Hiroshima nuclear disaster sites to try to prevent the radioactive water from leaking into the water table.
Oh,
they've tried to freeze the ground to contain the radioactive water.
Yeah.
But, you know, not a perfect solution.
I actually,
when I was going over this story and the other one, I was actually thinking, you know, what would be a solution?
Mm.
You know how we have fuel taxes that are supposed to go into highway maintenance funds.
Mm-hmm.
When you pay a gas tax, that's supposed to go to maintaining and building roads. Mm-hmm. It's dedicated to that. When you pay auto registration, it's supposed to have the same purpose.
Mm.
I think that when these companies are extracting resources and then selling them to the various companies that need them, I think we need a tax on those products that realistically reflect at the end of the day, essentially in an escrow fund, or as it was once called for Social Security, a lockbox, that will provide the money regardless of bankruptcy for remediation. It
That's
shouldn't
a good
be left
idea.
Up to the end of the product, at the end of the factory's life.
And yeah.
You know, it's like then we've already given out dividends and we've already taken profits and blah, blah, blah. We have no money. You know, we don't have billions of dollars to do this remediation. Well, over the 20, 30, 50 years that this plant was in operation, there should have been an excise tax on everything they sold that could then be used to remediate the property properly. And that way everybody can walk away and it gets done.
Yeah, that is a good idea. It's very much a what is feasible now situation, because there are already a good number of resource extraction projects all over North America. And
some are starting, some are in the middle, and some are near the end of their lives, but it could apply to any and all of them.
It would apply to any and all of them. So they can, you know, they're already going, we can start planning for the cleanup of when they finish right now. I think a sort of more forward thinking and, more, I don't know, robust solution is to reduce the amount of resource extraction that we do by increasing, you know, how much material we recycle and, you know, using production processes that allow for recyclable materials and repairable products and this sort of thing. But that is more future changes. Right now, something like that, you know, required contribution into a environmental cleanup escrow would be a solution for right now, or something to at least help right now. So that's definitely worth considering.
Well, what I think is interesting, and I'm looking to see where the byproduct list was. They're talking about things like boron and selenium and some of the others.
Boron, selenium, sulfates, and other toxic heavy metals into the
lower. And then there's another place in the story where they discuss some arsenic, lead, and mercury.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the ideal solution would be these are necessary industrial chemicals.
Yeah.
And essentially, if the technology can be developed, these places would make terrific mines.
Yeah.
You know, just reduce the amount of waste by reducing the amount of valuable materials among the waste. You might end up with something that you could actually use as soil extender.
If it was
clean enough.
This reminds me of another Tom Scott video. That's where I heard about Giant Mine. But just today, he talked about a mine in Germany where I forget what they were mining, but they had a major like sand byproduct. And at the time, like now they've realized that this sand has a valuable mineral in it that can be mined in turn. But at the time, they didn't know that. So because it wasn't toxic and because it didn't seem to have any, you know, harmful effect on the local populace, they just piled it up and just left it there. And a few years later, somebody came along and thought, hey, that's a big pile of
sand
material. Yeah. And we can turn that into a ski slope. And so they turned it into a giant sand-based ski slope, and a kind of theme park tourist attraction has built up around it. So it's a similar sort of idea of looking at the byproducts of a resource extraction process that is already going on and saying, okay, what can we do to make this not just something that sits there and harms the local community? So, yeah.
I would also mention sand is a funny thing. You know, to most people, sand is sand. Mm. But there are lots of different kinds of sand. For example, Saudi Arabia, which you would think has no shortage of sand, they have to import special sand, I think much of it from the United States, where, by the way, it's running out, for pool filters.
Oh, okay.
So some sand is good for pool filters. Some sand is good for glass making.
Because it's all based off of various different minerals.
It's not only the minerals, the silicon dioxide. There are also the impurities that have different qualities. Depending on how the sand was created, it has different shapes, different textures, different sizes. You have some sand that is used for fracking, that it's a specific kind of sand. When there is a shortage, it reduces fracking. And please, no stuff about that's a good thing or whatever. But, you know, it's just funny that, like, if you go to Hawaii, the sand is black and red. Mm. It's lava.
Yeah.
It's been broken down over eons. And I have no idea what qualities that might have. Maybe it would be good for very special exotic glasses. I don't know. But it's fascinating, something that you just put this vast word on sand. It's kind of like they say Inuits have like 100 words for snow, and apparently we have only one word for sand, and it has like maybe 100 different kinds of sand. Maybe we should be more specific. Mm. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We are also on kpft.org, listening live. You can podcast, which I suggest using your phone's app, or you can go to archive.kpft.org. It's always important to remember, you know, when I do my blog post, essentially I'm posting almost the entire script. There's extemporaneous stuff we say, but almost the entire script is pasted onto the blog post. So there's really a lot there, and you can check the sources I'm using because I'll reference them, I'll list them. But we are excerpting every story, some extremely heavily, and that's why we include links at thinkwingradio.com. You can go to show posts and more at the top of the page, find the show or show date. You can also type keywords into the search bar. And we're on social media taking questions, comments, and suggestions. Come on, folks, give us some suggestions. Tell us what you like and don't like. It would be appreciated. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And Andrew has his stuff.
I do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Last story from TheWashingtonPost.com. Ukraine war brings peace between Canada and Denmark. It's a barren and inhospitable rock plopped in a frigid channel in the Arctic. One geologist who visited characterized it as not a very exciting island. A Canadian legal analyst once tried to point it out on a map in a presentation he had prepared for lawmakers, but conceded that its size made it very difficult to see. Just so you know, there is a graphic in the actual article that manages to make it visible. Nevertheless, for some five decades, Canada and Denmark have squabbled, mostly but not always politely, over the not very exciting Hans Island, a 0.5 square mile mass in the Kennedy Channel of the Nares Strait, that's home to neither vegetation nor wildlife. The craggy outcropping, Tartupaluk in Inuit, lies between Canada's Ellesmere Island and Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark. Now, at long last, there is rapprochement in the dispute dubbed the Flag War, or also the Whiskey War. Officials from both countries, as well as Greenland, signed an agreement on Tuesday to resolve the long-standing fracas, the last remaining disagreement over a land border in the Arctic, with the Solomonic solution of dividing the island in two. Denmark gets about 60% of the island, Canada gets the rest. Both Canada and Denmark cast the historic agreement as an example of how border disputes can be resolved peacefully, without warfare or bitter legal wrangling at a time when the rules-based international order is under strain, a reference to, in part, to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As we stand here today, we see gross violation of international rules unfold in another part of the world, said Jeppe Kofod, Denmark's foreign minister. In contrast, we have demonstrated how long-standing international disputes can be resolved peacefully and playing by the rules. The dispute dates back to 1973, when Canadian and Danish diplomats were drawing up a maritime boundary in the Arctic. The line cut straight through Hans Island. The diplomats left the question of what to do about it unresolved. There is a pretty remote possibility that there are natural resources such as oil and gas on the island, but there haven't really been serious efforts to look. Canada does have several other disputes in the Arctic that are unresolved, which, you know, the article said there are no other Arctic disputes. Apparently they misspoke. But the other disputes in the Arctic that are unresolved include the United States and Canada over the Northwest Passage.
Well, that earlier mention was to the last remaining disagreement over a land border. So there are other disagreements, but apparently not between, I think we can say, UN member states over land borders, probably.
You know, I would really recommend reading the article because I had to cut out all the funny parts. Mm. It really is a very sort of entertaining way of disputing territory. Mm. You know, one of the things that I recall, we've talked about it sometime back on the show, is there was once a border dispute between the United States and Mexico over a small piece of land near the river, the Rio Grande. Mm. Apparently, as I recall, the border treaty between the U.S. and Mexico defines the border as the Rio Grande. Mm. And the river had slightly changed course, taking a piece of what had been American territory and putting it on the Mexican side. And after negotiations that I think may have gone on for several years, it was finally decided to cede that. It was a small amount of territory, admittedly, to Mexico. So, you know, friendly neighbors can do these things.
Yeah.
There is an island, and I'm trying to remember, I think it's between France. It might be between France and Spain. I can't swear. But there is a tiny little island that the agreement they have reached is that half the year it belongs to France, and the other half of the year it belongs. It's in a river. It's like in the sand or something.
Yeah.
And half the year it belongs to France, and half the year it belongs to Spain, or whichever the other country involved is. And it's like there are ways of working these things out that are a lot less expensive in so many ways than warfare.
They've got a timeshare in that instance.
Yeah, they have a timeshare. That's a good way of putting it.
Well, I think you know, to briefly acknowledge this, especially on the heels of a story involving Native and First Nations people, you know, this is somewhat of a could be viewed as a, you know, dispute over land between two colonizing entities. And there is the aspect of the last remaining disagreement over a land border, perhaps between two nations on equal footing, not a nation and a what was the term used in U.S. law?
Let me go back and see the other article.
It was a
tribal territories are not recognized. This is a story we didn't get to.
Right.
Tribal story, and we'll get to it next week. Tribal territories are not recognized as separate and sovereign nations. They are rather considered, quote, domestic dependent nations.
Right.
You I had a discussion about that, thinking maybe there was some kind of protectorate, and maybe this is sort of a gentler way of putting it.
And so, you know, it's worth mentioning and it's worth acknowledging this. But I will say, in the spirit of the original article, that, this is a the whiskey war, as it's referred to over this little island here, is, you know, quite one of the more lighthearted border disputes that exists. And,
You know, if life and limb are not at stake, you can be polite about it. I also want to point out, going back to the Indian story about the coal plants and the coal ash, that story is actually much, much longer and talks a lot about Indian life and Indian views and how they see their ancestry and their ancestral traditions and whatnot, and the spiritual way they see it. So I really do recommend reading it. It's a much longer story that I condensed down substantially. So, you know, go to thinkwingradio.com, go to the web posts, look at the story links, because sometimes they're a lot more interesting than just the details I pick out to read to you. Okay, I think we are more than done. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, and very patient person is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you have found the show interesting, informative, entertaining, and look forward to speaking to you again next week. Take care.
See you later.
It's not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore.
Some stations in Texas have lost their local announcers. Some cities even use a national music service to bring a limited variety of music to their communities and have lost that connection to their towns. Houston is lucky. KPFT is programmed by your neighbors, folks who live down the street from you, folks that you know. KPFT knows what's going on in the community and reflects performances that happen right here. Become a sustaining member today and keep KPFT local. Your donation at 713-526-5738 makes it all possible. Please call now. That number is 713-526-5738. Or if it's more convenient, use our website, kpft.org. And while you're there, listen in. And thank you.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's How in the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston's community station.